Freedom News Hour with Jake Towns, Walt Thiessen, and Gene DiNardo, Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with my co-host, Gene DiNardo. Jake Towns may or may not be joining us today. We're not quite sure. He's got an emergency with a family pet, a cat, I guess, that's having a diabetic coma situation, which doesn't sound so good. So he may not be joining us. But Gene and I will be carrying on today here on Thursday, August 18th, 2011. And not a whole lot of news going on, except we are taking notice of the fact that the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which a week ago was tanking, this past week was up almost about 500 points, but it fell back down again. It's almost at the exact same point it was last week. It closed today around 10,990. And I think that basically shows that the recession's definitely here. The investors think that's true. It's not really going away. And, Gene, I guess there's nothing really new on that point.
Yeah, is this a another? I really don't follow it, but is this another down day?
Yeah, it was down about almost 500 points today. So,
oh
yeah,
wow,
yeah,
that's a big one.
They've been flying high, and then boom, they fell again. So you know, basically the market is tanking, and nobody in Wall Street is happy today.
So it what did you say? Was it 10,900?
It closed today at 10,990.
And the high point was close to, what was it?
14? It was about 500 points higher.
Oh, five. No, I mean, originally about a month ago was...
Oh, a month ago, it was quite a bit higher. I'm not sure what the exact numbers were,
yeah.
But it's been falling rather, you know, precipitously, mainly because people are beginning to realize that despite everything that the Federal Reserve has done, we're still not getting any better.
Yeah, and I wonder what you say mostly they invest in money-type funds or something like that, because the money has to go somewhere, right?
Well, right now, a lot of people have been running into treasuries, which is U.S. dollar-based, and that's probably the favorite place to go to. A lot of other people have been going into gold, though. Gold has been getting
right.
A lot more respect, and as a result, it's been hitting new highs. At one point, it reached 1,800. Now it's currently, I'm not sure what today's close is, but I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1775 or so. Somewhere like that, I can go look it up. But silver's also been up, so more and more people are beginning to move into the precious metals, but still predominantly most people run into the dollar because that is the essential reserve currency of the world. There are other reserve currencies too, but that's the one everybody looks to. And it has created an ongoing, very interesting situation where if the dollar is the currency that's in trouble and there's nowhere else to run, what do? Do you run back into the barn? It's burning. That's essentially what the investors have been doing.
Yeah, it's perceived as the relatively safest investment. You know what's kind of interesting is, and I'm sure you realize this, you always hear about, oh, consumers, you know, if consumers would just start spending,
yeah.
Boy, you know, that would turn around the economy. Well, how come nobody ever touches these investors, you know? So, trillions of dollars in investment dollars. Nobody says, well, if they'd stop just investing in these worthless piece of paper and just go out and buy stuff, you know? You never hear that.
That's true. I mean, they've got all this money. Well, they start buying up the consumer goods, and then the economy takes off again.
Yeah, right.
So, of course, it wouldn't last very long, but still.
No,
it'd be fun to watch.
Pretty good boost there.
And, of course, the other news this week was the Iowa straw poll, which everybody agrees doesn't really amount to anything. But probably there are two pieces of news that came out of the Iowa straw poll. Three pieces, really. Well, the first one is that Michelle Bachmann won it. She got 4,823 votes at the straw poll. And Ron Paul came in a close second, 4,671. Governor Rick Perry of Texas, at the very last instant, surprised nobody by jumping into the race, and he ended up garnering about 768 votes out of the straw poll, but because he jumped into the race and because he's perceived to be a somewhat more electable candidate than other candidates, the news media are treating him very nicely, so he's now considered one of the front runners, and he's also doing very well in the national polls. Did you see the John Stewart piece, though? The one that
appeared
on
Comedy
Central?
Yeah, you referred it to me, and that was funny. He's always funny, but that was good. Because it's so true, you know, you have, and in fact, I just saw an article in the Oregonian where they mentioned the top three, and it was the same thing, you know, no mention of Ron Paul. And
yeah.
That's just...
If you haven't seen the video, folks, you can see it on our website at www.freedomnewshour.com. I posted it on our list of videos there on the homepage. It's right at the top. And you'll have to sit through a 30-second commercial because it's Comedy Central, of course. But after that, you'll watch 4 minutes of some very funny footage that shows all the different ways that mainstream media are dissing Ron Paul.
It's hysterical, and it's been going on. You know, of course, this, I think, is probably his strongest showing so far.
Absolutely, yeah. He's doing very, very well.
But it is funny just that they can ignore him. And, you know, whether you're a supporter of Ron Paul or not, it just seems strange. And, you know, at some point, I guess if he stays in second place, they'll have to pay some attention to him.
I love the ones, and there were like three or four networks that Stewart grabbed footage from, who all were saying, we now have a three-candidate race. And the three candidates are Michelle Bachmann, Rick Perry, and then it varied who they were going to say it was. It was either Tim Pawlenty or Rick Santorum, or even one said John Huntsman, who was, to a point, I've got 69 votes in the straw poll, because that makes him a major player, right?
Yeah, when he said if he was in a restaurant, the
That's right. If all Huntsman's supporters who voted for him at the Iowa straw poll showed up in a Quiznos in Ames, Iowa, the fire marshal of Ames, Iowa would look around and say, yeah, that's okay. There's more room in the back. No problem.
Come on, bring some more in.
That was great. So if you get a chance, watch that video. That was just absolutely precious. And it does a very good job of showing that despite the fact that Ron Paul in the national polls, he's only less than one percentage point behind Michelle Bachmann.
And that's amazing.
Yeah, and yet he gets absolutely no respect at all. It's ridiculous.
So, yeah, if it goes to the end, I mean, you know the Republican Party will ignore him.
They're
going to
do their
what.
Best, and the media are doing their best to ignore him.
So he would, in order for him to get nominated, he would need basically to win by a landslide of popular votes, you know, in the different races. And that's probably
the question that comes
to
my mind is, what's it going to take for him to actually get significant media coverage? And I think he's going to have to win a primary to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's the only way it's going to happen.
I think he's going to have to win more than one.
And, if he did win, it's probably going to be something like, and today in the New Hampshire primary, Michelle Bachmann came in second.
Yeah, right. It was the funniest one was when the two newscasters were going back and forth, and the guy was actually at a Ron Paul meeting, I think, right? And they said, well, we're not going to show you pictures of this, but we will get you some of Sarah Palin.
That's right.
Oh, please, let's just kind of forget the Ron Paul. Get a Sarah Palin.
Who isn't even scoring anywhere in the national polls.
Or even running, really.
And not running,
like,
yeah. She's not even a candidate.
Because it's I guess you could still come in. I mean, you know what gets me? It's more than a year away. You know, and here it's like front page news, and God, it's like a quarter of the, you know, there's a 4-year term, and we spend more than a quarter of that term, you know, on the next election. It's crazy.
Well, yes, except when you think about it, it's actually not that far away because the Iowa caucuses is coming January.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, so it's really not that far away.
And I guess when is the nomination?
The nominating process would be all next winter and spring. That's when all the primaries are held, and then the actual convention is held next summer.
It just seems to me, you know, to take up a year to elect somebody that serves for 4 years. You know, of course, our president's out campaigning already, or, you know, what seems to be campaigning, and, you know, that's going to take up his time. But I guess all the problems are solved, so he can go do that.
Well, Jake Towne has joined us. Jake, I don't know if you were hearing what we're talking about, but we were laughing about the John Stewart video and how Ron Paul is just being totally dissed by the media. Are you there, Jake? Oh, guess he hasn't on with us just yet, but he'll be joining us shortly. Something else I want to touch on. Now, Rick Perry, of course, because he jumps into the race at the last minute like this, he is he's considered a major player because he is supposedly, quote, electable, unquote.
That's why, huh?
Right, yeah, that's the whole idea behind supporting him. And, of course, he made his big splash this week by calling Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, a traitor, which was actually a lot worse than anything Ron Paul had ever said.
Yeah.
And it's a deliberate attempt to pander to the Paul supporters and the Tea Partiers and so forth.
Yeah.
The thing that intrigues me most, though, is his big claim to fame is that while the economy has been in recession and jobs have been shrinking all over the place, in Texas they've actually had some increase in jobs.
Absolutely.
So Perry's taking credit for that. Mm-hmm. Don't know if you saw it, but there was an article in U.S. News, it appeared on usnews.com a couple days ago, called How Rick Perry Created Jobs in Texas. And it's a really interesting article. It goes into quite a bit of detail. And the bottom line is this. You know where most of the jobs came from?
Immigration or migration or something like that?
Not too far off base. No, actually, the largest percentage of jobs came from new federal jobs, new state government jobs, and new local government jobs.
That's classic.
So, I mean, basically, while for the rest of the country, Federal jobs were up 4.3%. In Texas, they were up 7%. For the rest of the country, state government jobs were actually down 0.1%, but in Texas, they're up 8.4%.
Oh.
And local government jobs across the country are down 1.7%, but in Texas, they're up 6.1%.
That's classic. And they also, that state, you know, the state of Texas, as far as poverty and all those problems, it's right up there in the top. I mean, they're in pretty bad shape. You know, they have the highest percentage of people without any kind of health coverage, and I think they have one of the highest poverty rates. So really, I mean, if I was him, I wouldn't be bragging too much.
No, and yet this is going to be part of what he's bragging about, because his big thing is that he is the conservative candidate, you know, and he...
Right.
Oh, you heard about his big prayer fest before the Iowa caucus, or
no,
the Iowa trouble.
No, I didn't hear about that. Right.
Oh, yeah, he went down to Houston, and they organized this massive, I guess you could kind of call it sort of like an evangelical, what do you call those?
The
prayer rally. Prayer rally,
yeah.
Jake, come on, saves the day for me. A prayer rally. And, of course, it had massive media coverage, just like all prayer rallies get, right? And he... The whole purpose of it was to pray for President Obama.
Oh.
I mean, if that doesn't show what kind of a Christian he is, what does?
Well, get the moral vote. You know.
Jake, glad you could make it today. I'm sorry to hear about what's happening with your family pet, but we're glad that you were able to make it on the air with us. And we were talking earlier about the Jon Stewart video that was dissing... how the media are dissing Ron Paul, and I presume you saw the video. Did you have any comments you wanted to share before we moved on that one?
Oh, well, just on the whole Rick Perry and Ron Paul thing, I think that, you know, what Rick Perry's obviously doing is selling Texas to the rest of the nation, you know, as this independent place where things can get fixed. But the whole thing is that Texas itself has lost jobs just like any other state in the United States. And a poll that just came out on August the 17th was about how, you know, Congressman Ron Paul is still well ahead of Rick Perry. In a poll conducted by the Azimuth Research Group, found Mr. Paul beating Perry 22% to 17%. So there's still what's kind of funny, it's almost like the phenomenon with Congress people. A lot of times congressmen outside of their district are very unpopular, or I should say the reverse. Inside their district, they're very popular because they tend to try and bring in the bacon for the people in their particular constituency. But in this case, like, you know, a governor in a state, and I think the Atlantic article also covered it, like a governor really isn't all that powerful, and there really isn't anything that Perry has done that has been that earth-shaking.
But
I agree with you saying, you know, his recent tirades against the Federal Reserve,
yeah.
that really just kind of highlights, and, you know, that was the first headlines that hit. That's actually very, very good news, I think, because it's recognized as a kind of like a punching bag for people to go after. And I think that's hopefully just the beginning of a flood of public sentiment and bad sentiment against the Federal Reserve, because they are the ones, you know, gold hit another all-time high today. You know, the dollar is getting worth less and less, and all those people that are out there working really aren't having any purchasing power anymore.
The question that comes to my mind about that, though, is how much does Rick Perry actually understand the Federal Reserve and the role that it has played in the economic turn down in the bubble and the popping of the bubble and all that? How much of that does he really understand? And I don't know if the media are going to ask him questions that help, you know, elicit the truth about that, but my suspicion is he doesn't understand any of it at all.
Well, he didn't
explain. He probably gets the basics. I mean, you know, the basics about how the $16 trillion went to fund mainly foreign banks during the 2008 credit crisis. And I think he also gets the balance that they're printing up money to pay for things. But he's not really campaigning against that. If you follow his words closely, he's campaigning against, you know, we need to know what they're doing and all this other stuff. And, you know, if he were elected into power, you know, the question is, what would he do? And I think it would be just like anybody else. He would use the Federal Reserve for his own, you know, to fund his own pet programs.
Well, sure, because you have to pay for all those government jobs you created, right?
Yep.
Yeah, you got to pay for those.
Absolutely. Well, but last week we were touching on the fact that there were two European nations that had been considering the idea of curtailing short selling.
Shortly after we went off the air, another story came out, this one from the New York Times, saying that there are actually four European nations that are involved in considering that. That would be France, Belgium, Italy, and Spain, and they were all planning to initiate these new rules effective Friday. Now, I haven't been able to find anything that tells us what's been happening since then and whether or not other countries are joining in, but I did want to follow up to last week's report, because what we originally reported as something that might happen, it actually did happen, and it actually got, there was a bandwagon that got jumped on by two other countries, so interesting stuff happening over there. Meanwhile, here on this side of the pond, interesting things happening between Allstate and Goldman Sachs. Jake, what are the details about that?
Well, Allstate sued Goldman Sachs over bad mortgage backed securities, saying that more than $122 million in mortgage-backed securities that the insurance company bought beginning in 2006 were completely fraudulent. Allstate sent a statement Monday that it filed a lawsuit in New York against Goldman Sachs and certain affiliates. The complaint alleges violations of state laws involving residential mortgage-backed securities. Let's see what else is the the value of these securities plunged as the housing market bubble burst, and I guess my only comment is, you know, the famous slogan of Allstate is, "You're in good hands with Allstate." But obviously, if you're investing money with them, or if they are taking insurance premium proceeds and investing it, they probably took a massive loss. So it's very interesting to see this. It reminds me a little bit of the, I think it was like $30 to $100 million, or it might have been actually up to $12 billion, that Morgan Stanley was seeking against, I believe, Goldman Sachs on a derivative contract default, credit default swap gone bad. So we're starting to see some of these financial giants kind of trying to tear at each other, because they're obviously getting each other raw deals.
Which they would have happened a lot earlier if it wasn't for the federal bailouts. They would have been going somewhere for the money.
I guess if you're an Allstate annuity customer, you probably are looking for Allstate to come up with a new slogan which says, "Your hands are tied with Allstate." Meanwhile, there's not been a whole lot of news lately about what is going on with the healthcare industry, and that's kind of surprising, especially considering how much of a push there was last year for reform and how much anger and resentment there was over on the Tea Party side and so on and so forth. But it's been relatively quiet on that front. And yet, Gene, you were able to dig up some very interesting news about a rather unusual approach to medicine. What's that all about?
Yeah, this is interesting. It's actually a company that two Portland doctors formed. They actually tried to start some legislation, I think at the state and also at the federal level, which didn't go through, but they decided to start these companies. It's called Zoom Care, and it's been described as equal part doctor's office and emergency room. And they have big goals. You know, they would like to spread this around, but they started it in 2006, and it recently opened its eighth clinic, this one on a North Mississippi Avenue corner, all later in Portland. It has set up shops in trendy neighborhoods such as Tannisbourne, Bridgeport, Village, Hawthorne, and Pearl District. A Seattle clinic is in the works, as well as one in San Francisco and more clinics in Portland. The co-owner is Dr. Dave Sanders, and he quotes, he said, "We like to see a clinic on every corner in every great neighborhood in this city," which I guess he means he doesn't want to have them in not-so-great neighborhoods, but he says down the road, Zoom Care will go global. Sanders and his partner, Dr. Albert DiPiero, tried to reform healthcare with a ballot measure. Now they say they are remaking healthcare from the bottom up. They run the fastest-growing chain of clinics in Portland, stressing low overhead and neighborhood access to make it easier for the uninsured, those with cash at least, to get prompt care. The chain has one, which is to say they're not serving people who have no resources at all. The chain has won many fans thanks to its customer service focus, fixed-rate care, and on-time appointments. But the firm has also drawn criticism over its denial of Medicaid and Medicare programs for low-income people and sparked complaints to the state from employees who claim they worked long shifts without breaks. Goes on to kind of describe one of the clinics. It says cheerful staff greet patients in the clean, bright interior. It has a 1,000-square-foot interior. It includes x-ray facility, exam rooms, and laboratory to test blood. Terry Bunker, who owns the Bridge City Health Clinic, says it's fast food medicine. He goes on to say they fill a niche. It's certainly better than going to the emergency room. The Zoom Care markets itself as a one-stop shop for illness and injury as well as a preventative, primary, and urgent care. Appointments are a flat rate, and this is interesting because this reminds me of I've seen Ron Paul, who's also a doctor, have his rates are actually published on the net. The rates are $129 if you have insurance and $99 if you don't. Key to the success is containing labor costs.
So basically, a single visit costs you $99 if you don't have insurance.
If you don't have insurance, it costs you $99. And actually, and this is interesting. Okay, so $129 if you do have insurance. Now, actually, the opposite is true in the status quo system. If you have insurance, you actually pay less than you would if you had cash. I read a report on a guy who actually went into a coma. Just fell unconscious on the street, and somebody who he didn't even know called an ambulance. They took him to the hospital. They treated him. He ended up not having anything long-term that was wrong with him, and I think they released him the next day or something. Well, he got a bill for $10,000, including something like $1,200 or $1,400 for the ambulance he didn't even ask for. You know, somebody else asked for it. And he said, well, show me. And so he had it itemized. Well, anyway, he found out that if he had insurance, it would have been $3,000, this $10,000 bill. So they ended up going to court, suing the hospital and saying, you know, we'll pay the $3,000. We're not going to pay the $10,000. So they actually charge people more if you don't have insurance, which is just amazing. And this is kind of the opposite aspect. So what they're trying to do is kind of a – It's sort of a competitive thing, which is, you know, obviously what's lacking in the healthcare field.
Interesting stuff. I mean, the reason that has been given time and time again over the years as to why it costs more for the uninsured is that basically they're arguing that the insured have been subsidizing the uninsured, so in order to compensate for that, you have to charge more for things like the, you know, the emergency room visits and so forth. That's how you end up covering your costs. But here's what are they called, Zoom Incorporated?
It's called Zoom Care, yeah.
Zoom Care, okay. Well, Zoom Care coming in and trying to reverse that. That's an interesting thing. It'll be very interesting to watch, see how that plays out in the marketplace. I mean,
well, what I think is amazing about it is, you know, they actually publish their prices, and we all know we walk into a hospital, and the only place you find a price is at the snack bar. You know, they conceal the prices, and you know that's the whole thing that's missing. Once the prices are published, and you get competition,
well, they end up getting a decent market share. That will put pressure on the hospitals and the clinics and so forth to publish their prices, and then that starts to at least have an opportunity, perhaps, to shift the way the cost structure is set forth.
Yeah, that to me seems, that's comparable to a visit to the dentist's office. It's not cheaper. So, I don't know what the cost is for a checkup now, but I imagine it's $200 to $300 minimum for a basic one. And so that seems reasonable.
I don't know. It's very strange. But, Jake, you got any take on this before we move on?
I just thought that, with the whole Obamacare plan, I thought everybody's okay now.
No.
Yeah, if you own a drug company.
Problem solved. One other piece of news that I wanted to touch on this week that kind of came out just after last week's show, it was an article that appeared in Bloomberg, and it's entitled The Stress of Carrying Cash. Subtitle, Investors, Companies, and Banks Have Too Much of It, and It's Not Doing Any of Them Much Good. Now, this kind of touches back on stuff that we've talked about many times here on the Freedom News Hour, how all the bank bailouts and so forth have just poured tons and tons of cash into the banks, and they're just not letting it out. And, of course, that's been driving Ben Bernanke crazy, because he figured if he created all this new cash, they'd start letting it out, and it would drive the economy crazy, and blah, 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 blah. Well, it's not happening. Well, this article kind of tells a little bit about that story. I'm just going to read a little bit from it. It says, can too much cash possibly be a good thing? Right now, the answer is yes. In the U.S., individuals, banks, and the Federal Reserve find themselves locked in a vicious cycle of retrenchment. It plays out like this. Households worried about the economy and gyrating markets are piling into cash. That puts a strain on banks, which have few opportunities to put that money profitably to work, but still have to pay interest and maintenance fees on the funds they take in. Conundrum drove Bank of New York Mellon, the world's largest custody bank, to announce plans in early August to begin charging clients for cash balances above $50 million.
to, quote, pass on costs incurred from sudden and insignificant increases in U.S. dollar deposits, All this is frustrating the Federal Reserve, which to revive the economy has kept its target rate at near zero for 32 months, blah, 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 blah. And the quote from Rick Ashburn, chief investment officer at Creekside Partners, a Lafayette investment firm, is, we're all drowning in cash. So the question for you guys is, what happens if you get too much cash and it doesn't get spent?
Well, I think this goes back to what we were saying about the investors having all this capital. You know, we're always, like we were saying, you know, why don't they spend it?
I think it also goes back is to when people begin to realize that their dollars aren't worth as much, it can lead to kind of like a psychological shift. And once, you know, what they call the velocity of money picks up, the prices of everything picks up can pick up very, very quickly. You know, not that we're anywhere near hyperinflation just yet, but like back in the Weimar Republic, to give some people an idea of how it would be if you sat down in a coffee house and ordered coffee, by the time it arrived, the price would be different, and by the time you got the bill, it would be different. So it's a very ludicrous type of situation, but that's what occurs when you have all this money printing. And I think that what is kind of correct is that, you know, the money has been piling up at the banks. The banks have been persuaded to not lend it out since they're being paid interest by the Federal Reserve. Of course, the Federal Reserve is just creating that interest out of thin air. So they are slowly adding to the money supply, and it'll be very interesting to see where things go, because you know, gold just hit a high of somewhere around $1,825 per troy ounce, an all-time high in nominal dollars, and that's just you know, just another signifies you know, another canary in the coal mine, saying that the dollar is becoming worth less and less.
Absolutely true. Well, we're going to touch on this and more after the break. We're going to take a break here for a couple messages, and afterward we're going to talk about this being the 40th anniversary of the U.S. taking the world off of what was left of the gold standard. Plus, we're going to talk about an interesting talk that was given at the recent GATA event. That's the organization that Bill Murphy chairs. He was on our show a few months back. I guess it was back in January he was on. And Alistair MacLeod gave a very interesting speech called Beyond the Tipping Point from their meeting in London that took place a week or two ago, and we're going to share some details from that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and we'll be right back after these messages on the Progressive Radio Network. Yeah, run back to your radio dial. Turn it up, because we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Walt, Jake, and Gene here. And by the way, you can always check the latest and greatest at our website, www.freedomnewshour.com, where you'll find, among other things, a bunch of videos, including the latest video from John Stewart that we posted there. That's the one where he takes the media to task for not including the 13th floor in the hotel, Ron Paul, and the discussions about who the leading candidates are, so that'll give you a good chuckle. And this year we're actually celebrating a 40th anniversary. Well, I shouldn't say celebrating. In fact, I shouldn't even say that we're even noticing it, because most of the major media haven't paid any attention to it at all, but our own Jake Town is. And Jake, what happened 40 years ago that's interesting to us today?
Well, I believe it was August the 15th, President Nixon closed the gold window, which was the end of all ties to gold whatsoever with money for the first time in American history. And a lot of times, for the first time in world history, all nations were on a paper currency that was unbacked by anything. From 1933 until 1974, U.S. citizens were even banned from owning physical gold bars and coins, could only own jewelry. But what Nixon did in the course of one weekend was he imposed wage and price controls and removed the tie that foreigners had to claiming gold, since the United States no longer had enough gold at the current rates to survive. So he just, in effect, said, okay, dollar, we're defaulting, and generated quite a bit of chaos for a little while. There's stories of a young American who's now quite old, who was American growing up and was traveling with his parents over in Europe,
and for several days was unable to purchase anything. So they just ate, just stayed in the hotel because they couldn't buy anything outside of the hotel since they didn't have, no one was taking American dollars for a little while. So it generated quite a bit of economic stress. It led to the stagflation in the 1970s. Led to the oil shocks. It led to the skyrocketing price of gold up until 1980. Pretty much was a very bad decision. And it's funny because when you go back and watch Nixon's speech, I just have this feeling that it's going to be repeated because in the speech he blames the money, money speculators for all the problems of the country. He doesn't at all talk about the spending on the Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society and of the Vietnam War that was really the key expense in the dollar being so devalued.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. The people who are in charge never actually point the fingers at themselves, do they? Even if they're the ones who are causing all the problems.
No, because they'd lose their job.
Absolutely. They'd get voted out the next time around. I said earlier that the mainstream media aren't paying any attention. I shouldn't have actually said all of the mainstream media. There was actually a small notice put out by Reuters, of all things. And the name of the article, the title of the article, was 40 Years On From Gold Standard, Bugs Crow. Now, that's a rather mixed metaphor, but at least they noticed the fact that 40 years ago, Nixon took the gold window out of existence and basically removed what was left of the gold standard. The article doesn't actually talk about that very much, but the only thing the article talks about is how the gold bugs, that's where the Bugs Crow metaphor comes from, how the gold bugs have been all along saying that gold is actually the real money and that this paper stuff that we all have to deal with is the fiat fake kind, and that gold is the one that has the real value. And the article says, well, now they're crowing because here we are 40 years on, and gold is rising like crazy, and the dollar's in trouble, and sure enough, what the gold people have been saying all along looks like it might have actually been true. Very scary stuff if you're a fiat money person. But thanks for the report on that, Jake, because that is interesting stuff. Also wanted to point to an interesting tax scheme that Gene has been able to dig up. I loved your label that you passed along, your note to me. You labeled it conservatoid. Give us an idea of why he chose that particular name, because I thought that was a particularly interesting name.
Well, actually, I've run across the term conservatoid as it's kind of a reference to conservatives who claim to be libertarians. That's how I understand it. So I just kind of threw that in there, though. I wasn't saying that this came from the libertarian conservatoid front, because it doesn't. But there, we all know about the tax. I guess it was a letter that the conservative lawmakers signed saying they wouldn't raise taxes. Well, this doesn't really, and there was quite a few. If I remember, it was like 70-some. I'm not sure. But this is a completely different scheme, and this is a system of flat tax. And there's a quote by Rick Perry. He's been in the news. It says, "We're dismayed at the injustice that nearly half of all Americans don't even pay any income tax." And that's kind of what they base this whole – it's basically a system of flat tax with no low-income exemption. So, you know, even if you made, say, $2,000, you would be taxed whatever the flat tax would be. Most common percentage is 15%. Well, one commentator here, Ruth Marcus, takes Rick Perry to task, and she goes on to say, "The Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center estimates that 46.4% of households will owe no federal income tax in 2011. This is, for the most part, not because people have chosen to loaf. It's because they are working but simply don't earn enough to owe income taxes based on the progressive structure of the tax code and provisions designed to help the working poor and lower-income seniors." She explains, a couple with two children earning less than $26,400 will pay no federal income tax this year because their $11,600 standard deduction and four exemptions of $3,700 each reduce their taxable income to zero. The basic structure of the income tax simply exempts subsistence levels of income from tax. Now, this system, you know, that they're putting forward, and I don't know how much backing it has, but I know it does have some backing from some lawmakers, would forget about any kind of exemption at the bottom end. And then it goes on to say, of those households that do not owe income taxes, about a third earn $10,000 a year, and a slightly smaller share earn between $10,000 and $20,000. More than three-fourths earn $30,000 or less. In addition, the notion that these households pay no taxes is flat-out wrong. They pay, leaving aside state and local sales taxes, income and property taxes, federal gasoline and other excise taxes, and most significantly, payroll taxes on every dollar they earn. And that's a great point, because that's all the payroll tax is a tax. Two-thirds of the households that pay no federal income tax still ante up for payroll taxes. Fewer, 1 in 5, 18% of all households pay neither income nor payroll taxes, so it's more like 25%. Nearly all of these are elderly and have incomes below $20,000. So anyway, she's saying that the reason isn't so much because people just get out of paying taxes, they just can't afford it. And I posed this question to somebody I was discussing this with, and I basically said, well, okay, flat tax is fine. I told them, first of all, I'm not for any kind of income tax. But then they said, well, we got this flat tax, but everybody has to pay it. Everybody has to have a stake. I said, well, look, so somebody makes $10,000, you want to take, say, $2,000 from them and what, give it right back in welfare payments? Because that's what you'd be doing.
Right.
They didn't really have an answer for that one.
It was very interesting. President Barack Obama and billionaire Warren Buffett recently were talking about taxes, and pretty much what they were both saying was Obama was saying to increase the taxes on all the rich people, and Buffett wrote a co-op for the New York Times where he went in and complained that while he may pay more in absolute taxes, he is paying less in terms of percentage than his secretaries and what have you.
Right.
And pretty much he tries to make the argument that, hey, come out and tax me because I'm making all this money and you guys don't have it and we need to have a shared sacrifice.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of problems with this. Number one is there's absolutely nothing stopping Mr. Buffett from writing a check to the U.S. Treasury and donating whatever he wants to, fund these wars and to fund Obamacare and to fund anything that he wants if he chooses to do so. He has not done so. Second of all, it doesn't work. And what also just came out in the whole idea of soaking the rich just came out an article in the Wall Street Journal called Millionaires Go Missing. And Maryland couldn't balance its budget last year, and the federal government also hasn't budgeted its balance since who knows when. So the state tried to close the shortfall by fleecing the wealthy. So politicians in Annapolis decided to create a millionaire tax bracket. So if you made over $1 million, they increased the top marginal income tax rate by 6.25%, 6.25. Then what ended up happening, so the state local tax rate got as high as almost 10%. And 1 year later, the Baltimore Sun at the time, this was a year ago, wrote that the rich would, quote, grin and bear it, unquote. And 1 year later, nobody's grinning. One-third of all the millionaires have disappeared from Maryland's tax rolls.
Mm-hmm.
In 2008, roughly 3,000 million-dollar tax income returns were filed by the end of April. This year, there's 2,000, so it's decreased by almost a third. One out of three has left the state. On those missing returns, the government has collected 6.25% of nothing. So 1,000 income tax returns, they got nothing. And instead of they thought they would get an extra $106 million by increasing the tax rate, provided those same 3,000 millionaires would file, the millionaires paid $100 million less in taxes than they did last year, even at the higher rates, because they were either reporting less, they either moved out of the state, or they didn't work as hard to make the money since they knew it was going to go to the government.
So you were saying that actually they had less millionaires filing the next year.
Well, they had less filing and they had far less in revenue. So this year only 2,000 filed. So the state of Maryland has 2,000 people that have made over $1 million in a single year. So there may be many more millionaires, but since they're only taxed on income, not their existing wealth. You know, maybe the government will get around to tasking their existing wealth, but it just kind of points out that what President Obama wants to do and what Warren Buffett wants to do just don't work, because either the people, you know, the producers of society or what have you, they're either going to do one of two things. They're not going to work as hard because the government's going to take the money, or number two, they're going to find a way to leave. They're going to go to South America, Latin America. I know individuals from the island country of Vanuatu in the Pacific, where they renounced their U.S. citizenship and just to get their wealth out of the country, since the U.S. tax rates, of course, are extremely high. Of course, Warren Buffett also didn't mention that the U.S. has the world's, I believe, highest rate of corporate tax of about 40% in the highest tax bracket, too. So the reality is, when you're getting your paycheck from your government, from your company, the government's already taken 40% of what you could possibly have.
Warren Buffett, you know, also didn't mention that he got quite a bit of his fortune from government regulation. I mean, he made most of his money on what's called the float, which is the difference between the premium, what was it, Berkshire Insurance? He would take, the insurance companies take in premiums, and the float is the difference between the premiums they take in and what they pay out. And a lot of that's due to regulation. I mean, if you have a competitive industry, something like a float, the difference between a premium and what insurance company pays out would be much less. And what he did was take that. You know, he's a smart guy, so he invested the float, and that's where he built his fortune, at least started. And it's, you know, that's a simplified version of it. So I, you know, my philosophy is don't give to the rich. You know, I mean, and the income tax structure actually enables the government to redistribute funds not only to people who need food, but to people who are, you know, flying around in jets and eating in French restaurants.
And Warren Buffett, you know, he was never poor his whole life. He was the son of the Congressman Howard Buffett, who represented Nebraska during the 1940s. And what's really great is an essay that he wrote called Human Freedom Rests on Gold Redeemable Money. So his own dad wrote about how it was so important to have the money linked to gold, so that if the federal government got out of control, the people themselves could kind of bring it to heel by redeeming the paper money for the gold pieces. And that once you sever that tie, you are just pretty much saying to the government, spend whatever you want. We're not gonna, because the people really have no veto on what their representatives or so-called representatives are now doing.
Right.
So, and he goes on in the talk about the special interest groups and how it becomes very difficult once you have those forming, and it's a great read. I think it was a speech from 1948. If you Google Howard Buffett, "Human Freedom Rests on Gold Redeemable Money," you'll be able to read it.
It is fascinating that those who call for soaking the rich don't ever take into account the fact that the rich are the most mobile population on the planet, and that they would just, you know, leave en masse if they found that their wealth was being taken away from them.
Exactly.
You know, the rich already have the money, so, you know, when these taxes come up, who do they figure they're going to take money from? You know, everybody else.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Exactly.
But the thing that really gets my attention about this whole report, it goes right back to the beginning of what you were talking about, Gene, with Governor Rick Perry supporting this flat tax idea. That really catches my attention, because I think back to all the different candidates who are supposedly top-tier candidates who floated the idea of supporting a flat tax, and every one of them bombed big time.
Is that right?
It usually didn't take very long.
Uh-huh.
So the fact that Governor Perry is coming out in favor of this, what I would say is a really bad idea for a flat tax, and doing it as vehemently as he is apparently doing, I mean, how is he expecting to stay up there in the polls any longer than, say, a Steve Forbes did?
You know, I think you're right. The flat tax idea, you know, just doesn't go over with Americans as a whole.
It doesn't play.
Yeah, it doesn't play. And, you know, I've listened to people, and like I say, I don't believe in income tax at all, but, you know, they say, well, how about a flat tax with a basic exemption for people, you know, 30,000, 40,000 under, whatever. And I say, well, that sounds reasonable, but Americans as a whole really like the progressive income system.
They do, yeah. And so far there's really very little sign to suggest that they're ready to move away from that. So it strikes me that the media ought to be getting on Perry's case for basically trying to touch a third rail. And for what purpose? Who is he trying to appeal to? I don't quite get where he thinks he's going to get the votes for that.
I don't know.
Maybe just call me crazy, but it just seems to me a wacky political move from somebody who's supposedly a mainstream candidate. One other thing I wanted to touch on before I get to the Gattaz story, Gene, you had an interesting story about what's going on with federal pension funds. Can you give us just a quick overview on that?
Yeah, I'll just go through some figures because this basically still talks about what we were talking about last week with Harry and David. And let me get it up here. Let's see. Last week, the U.S. Bankruptcy Court had Harry and David to hand over its pensions. And anyway, it said that apparently they're getting Harry and David to put in $13 million of the pensions if they, you know, become profitable. But it goes on to say that the actual pension agency, which is the let's see if I can find it in here. It's the PBGC, which is a kind of a corporation that operates kind of publicly and privately. The agency has $79.5 billion in combined assets to cover obligations totaling $102.5 billion. So they're in a deficit of $23 billion. So this is just another agency of the federal government that is in dire straits right now. And you know, they're trying to figure out some ways to fix it. And you know, I think it's a complicated situation, and you don't want anybody to lose their pension, but a pension is basically just a debt. You know, it's a debt from the employer to the employee. And I think if we looked at it that way, people would look at it a little differently and maybe kind of think twice about it.
Well, you would hope so. It's hard to say exactly what's going to happen. One thing we do know is that we're not seeing the end of these pension underwater situations. We're going to see a lot more of them, and it's going to continue to get worse and worse, because in part so many of these pension plans are invested in the very same investments that have been tanking over the last 3 to 4 years.
Yeah, you're right. They're tied together, right?
Yeah, they're very much tied together. I mean, this real estate bubble was part of a much larger investment bubble, and that whole bubble is in a long-term pop mode, if you will. And we're continuing to see the fallout from this long-term popping that's going on, or perhaps it's a series of bubbles. I guess it depends on how you want to look at the metaphor, but it's basically a very bad situation. And the bottom line for the states, for the federal government, even for the private pension funds, is they are all in trouble, and there doesn't seem to be any way out short of another massive bailout. And, of course, the question becomes, does the American public stand still for another massive bailout? My personal reading on the public mood is no, they don't. So what happens?
That's a good point, yeah.
I mean, Jake, how do you see that playing out?
Well, we saw something happening in London not long ago, which was rioting and everything. And
yeah.
It's you know, in all seriousness, obviously, I hope that doesn't occur. But,
of course.
You know, what was funny was, you know, studies of the psychology that went into the London riots, you know, it was set off by something. Something always sets it off, whether, you know, it's Rodney King or what have you. But really, you know, what you had in London was people taking, you know, going, just committing open theft, raiding stores and taking whatever they could find that wasn't strapped down. It really didn't have anything to do with, you know, probably 95-99% of the looters had nothing in mind on the whatever the complaint was. So, and it's just, you know, mindful of, you know, their government's been mistreating them for so long, it's hard enough to kind of get by. And when you have a lot of unemployment and you have restful also males as well sitting around, governments tend to do is they tend to send them off to war so that they die. Well, we already have like a couple wars going on, so you know,
really,
what's going to happen next?
Yeah, and the big difference between England and us is that we have so many more guns here, you know, in private hands, and you know, that would be a terrible thing. But and I think what has saved us is our leniency and our laws for foreclosure and bankruptcy and stuff have kind of let people have time periods. You know, they don't just, the banks can't just march to your door and kick you out of your house. And
one thing on the weapons too, I mean, it cuts both ways. I mean, there was plenty of shop owners in London, like a lot of the Turkish and Indian areas, the shop owners actually banded up, and you know, they weren't armed, and they're trying to, you know, fend off people that are trying to take stuff from their stores.
Well, here in the U.S., I mean, I think that that's actually kind of a good thing, you know, to have enough arms out there that someone tries to break into your home or take stuff from your store or destroy some of your property, that you have some way to defend yourself. Because, again, well, you know, what was everybody complaining about with the London riots? They were complaining that, the British police were doing very little for a few days. And that's the thing. Like, people are so dependent on government these days. But when somebody shows up to take your stuff or food or whatever, in a lot of these situations, and you know what we were just talking about, a lot of these pensions, who's got a lot of these public pensions? Well, it's not just school teachers, it's firemen, it's police officers, it's the people that are kind of expected to help out the rest of society, and if they aren't pleased, you can't expect them to be out there while their families are getting attacked and all that stuff. So it's tough. And, the government's just kind of slowly, slowly but surely kind of going down this path.
And unfortunately, it's true. We're down to, like, the last minute or so of the show here, and so I'm not going to be able to spend a lot of time on the Goddess speech. That's the Gold Antitrust Action Committee meeting that took place in London this month. Where Alistair MacLeod gave a very interesting talk. What I will do is I'll read like the first couple paragraphs because it gives you a taste of it. Perhaps we'll be able to pick up on it next week. What he said was, I'm going to give you an overview of what is happening to money. My conclusion, he says, is we are heading for a collapse of paper money, or put another way, we are heading for hyperinflation, something we've talked about here on the show. This is the fundamental justification for hoarding sound money, which is, of course, gold and silver. The danger of hyperinflation has been building for decades. To fully appreciate this inflationary danger, we require a clear understanding of the difference between sound money and paper currencies. And the first thing we must understand is that the economic policies of the Keynesian and central bankers are not pure economics. Rather, and he has this sentence emphasized, rather it is the pursuit of social objectives by economic means. And then he goes on to describe that. That may be something we'll want to bring up in a future show because we're out of time for this one. But I wanted to at least get that in there, and next week perhaps we can go into more detail about it. Jake and Gene, we're out of time, but it's been a pleasure as usual.
Been fun. Jake, I hope
that
gets better.
And we'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Stay free, everyone.